the reason for cutting off her head, hands, and feet were if by some chance someone did find the body, they wouldn't know who it was.
She appeared more like somebody that would be baking cookies for the neighborhood children.
He told the officer that there were suspicious holes dug in the yard.
He went out in the morning in the backyard and he found 24 human teeth, all of them filled with silver and gold fillings.
24 silver and gold-filled teeth. Welcome to the Crime Stories Control Room. This is Murder Time. The story I'm pulling from the vault today is about an unlikely multiple murderer, a silver-haired serial killer that slays society's most vulnerable. Let's pick up the story in January 1988. Sacramento is seeing a spike in its homeless population. Here's crime writer Carla Norton.
Northern California in general is a good destination for homeless people. California has a very generous benefits program, and the weather's mild, the people are tolerant.
The Volunteers of America take up the homelessness challenge and put frontline counselors on the street. One of those counselors is social worker Judy Moise.
My job in the 80s was to locate people who were not getting services on the street and who were living homeless and mentally ill, unable to actually do it themselves.
Judy's looking for a stable home for her homeless client. He's 51-year-old schizophrenic Bert Montoya. Judy hears of a rooming house that takes in hard-to-manage tenants like Bert. And though the neighborhood has seen better days, the house is roomy and well-kept. The address is 1426 F Street. The proprietor is diminutive Dorothea Puente.
She said that she was in her 70s and that she had actually been a nurse in the Battle of Bataan during World War II. And I was very impressed with that.
Sacramento homicide detective John Cabrera explains the popularity of Puente's rooming house.
I think what made the boarding house that Puente had very popular with social workers and social agencies is the fact that she opened her arms to all. These are individuals with alcoholic problems, maybe drug problems, some mental problems.
And landlady Puente offers more than a place to sleep. Writer Carla Norton.
All of Dorothea's boarders were receiving various kinds of benefits, and she knew how to work the system. So if there was any way that they could get more, she would get more for them.
So Puente and her house full of elderly tenants seem a perfect fit for homeless Bert Montoya. He meets his roommates, a 64-year-old alcoholic named Dorothy Miller, and Leona Carpenter in her late 70s. But both women are gone by the time Bert moves to F Street on February 3rd, 1988. Detective Cabrera.
That's not uncommon with people that live in these boarding houses. They could just get up one day and walk away or move to another facility.
Bert's new neighbors include retired cook John Sharp and the hard-drinking Ben Fink. Carla Norton.
Benjamin Fink had a long history of checking into the ER with very high alcohol levels. After he got his check, he would go on binges and be a real heavy drinker.
In April of 1988, Ben Fink disappears. But Bert Montoya is adjusting well. Here's counselor Judy Moise.
We came back and he had a very nice haircut. He was very clean. He had some very nice clothes. It was amazing, the transformation. And we were just delighted that that he was getting the kind of help that he really needed.
Hey, Murder Time fans. If you've ever wanted to make your home feel safer, there's no better time than now. This week, our friends at Simply Safe are giving Murder Time listeners early access to all their holiday deals. 40% off their award-winning home security. We love Simply Safe because it has everything you need to make your home safe. Indoor and outdoor cameras, comprehensive sensors, all monitored around the clock by trained professionals who send help the instant you need it. These are SimpliSafe's biggest discounts of the year. You can get a complete home security system starting at just over $100. You can easily customize a system for your home online in minutes and even get free custom recommendations from SimpliSafe. There are no long-term contracts or commitments. It's a really easy way to start feeling a bit more peace of mind. SimpliSafe was even named Best Home Security System of 2021 by U.S. News & World Report. Take advantage of SimpliSafe's holiday deals and get 40% off your new home security system by visiting simplisafe.com/murdertime. Again, that's simplisafe.com/murdertime for 40% off your entire system. But for Judy Moise, delight is short-lived. A month later, Bert Montoya goes missing. No one at Volunteers of America has heard a peep for several weeks.
Alberto had been at Puente's, I think, about 6 months. And one of the staff people said, "Hey, guess what happened?" I said, "What?" And he said, "Alberto went with the room and board people down to Mexico to visit Dorothea's doctor, brother."
When Judy reaches out to Puente, the landlady assures her that Bert is due back soon. A few days later, Puente calls Judy again, working a brand new story. But Judy isn't buying.
And she said, "Well, you know what? Sunday while I was at Mass, a relative of his came by and just packed him up and took him, left a note for me."
Judy demands Puente show her some tangible proof. Soon after, Judy's phone rings.
I answered the phone, and this man said, "Hello, this is Don Anthony. I mean Michelle Obregon. And I have Alberto with me. He's my nephew, and he is with me in Utah. We're in Shreveport, Utah."
Shortly after, Puente follows up with a call of her own. She's working the long-lost uncle angle. Judy tells her straight out.
And I said, well, listen, I'm calling the police because the story had a lot of holes in it and she was obviously covering.
Judy contacts Sacramento police officer Richard Ewing and asks Ewing to follow up on Bert's disappearance.
I told him that there was a person that was living in the home named John Sharp and that he was a person that he could get the correct information from. John didn't have a mental illness. He wasn't an alcoholic like the other residents. And I felt that he would give him the true version of whatever did happen.
When he knocks on her door, Officer Ewing is invited in by Puente. And resident John Sharp does confirm Puente's story about Bert being picked up by relatives. But as he's leaving, Sharp surreptitiously slips Ewing a letter. Detective John Cabrera.
One of the tenants passed him a note, and on the note, it asked the officer to meet him at another location because he had something to tell the officer. So the officer subsequently met that particular tenant away from everybody else, and that tenant told him that Dorothea had asked the tenants to lie and to say that Bert had left with relatives.
And John Sharp shares other F Street mysteries with Ewing. He'd heard something big and heavy being dragged down the stairs the very night roomie Ben Fink had moved out. Sharp mentions a nasty, gross smell in the house. And then there's this.
He told the officer that there were suspicious holes dug in the yard and that he thought people were being buried in the yard.
Officer Ewing reaches out to missing persons and homicide detective John Cabrera. Cabrera spots trouble right off the jump.
Then you start doing all the checks that you can, you know, driver's license, all of the primary checks. Well, the first thing I found is that she was on federal parole for forgery of Social Security checks and also for putting stupefying drugs in her victim's drinks.
Cabrera discovers Puente is only 59, not in her 70s like she claims. And she's done time.
She served 36 months of a 5-year stretch. Posing as a nurse, Puente had drugged elderly patients, then ripped off their jewelry, checks, and credit cards. It's an ominous sign, and not a good one for missing Bert Montoya.
Things started to become a little bit more clear that this could be, you know, right in line with the person missing. He was receiving Social Security money. Nobody knew his whereabouts.
Detective Cabrera circles back to Judy Moise.
So then Detective Cabrera said, so what is it you want us to do? I said, I want you to go to the house. He said, do you want us to bring shovels? I said, sure.
On November 11th, 1988, homicide detectives John Cabrera and Terry Brown, along with Puente's parole agent, Jim Wilson, roll up on 1426 F Street. Puente answers the door.
I explained to her why we were there. Because of the report with Bert Montoya. She didn't seem mad or she didn't seem upset about anything. She just said, oh, yeah, you know, and she mentioned Judy Moise and that Bert had gone with relatives. And Dorothea was very believable in anything she said. She would look straight at you, tell you exactly, you know, what she was thinking or what she had to say. And she didn't even flinch a moment when I asked her to search her house. I checked everything. I looked under beds. I tapped the walls.
He doesn't find Bert, but he does find an empty prescription bottle.
And I looked at it, and it had the name of Dorothy Miller. And so I took that pill vial. I went back out into the living room where Dorothea was sitting with the other officers. And I said, who's Dorothy Miller? And I remember her telling me Dorothy Miller was a relative of hers, you know, and she had come and visited with her and probably left that behind.
Cabrera files that name. His cursory search of the rooming house complete, Cabrera asks Puente if it's all right for him to do a little digging.
I remember her kind of asking, you know, why I wanted to dig in the yard. And I told her, well, you know, I had some information that maybe somebody was buried there. She didn't even flinch. She said, oh, yeah. You know, please, feel free. We started digging into three particular areas in this little garden area. And it was about maybe 40 minutes, 45 minutes later, we started pulling up articles out of one of the holes that looked to be like a material. And then we had this pile of leather-looking small discs that accompanied the find of this material.
Then the digging detective's shovel hits something solid.
I climbed into the hole, and I kept pulling on it and pulling on it. And then eventually it broke loose. And when I'm sitting in the back of this hole and I'm looking down at this object in my hand, it's not a tree root. It was a human bone.
The detective asks Puente to come on down.
We walked her over to the hole and said, take a look there. You know, and she gave it one of these... You know, she gasped and, oh my gosh, and she became real nervous and kind of upset, and she didn't know what to think and didn't know anything about this. And we determined that the cloth material appeared to look like what might have been a dress or some type of blouse item.
But whose? Cabrera reaches out to Deputy Coroner Laura Santos. When she arrives and realizes what's in that yard on F Street, Santos orders a full forensic lockdown.
We should have a crime scene set up. Someone should guard the property tonight until tomorrow, and everybody can regroup. And that's what was done, basically.
The corpse they've uncovered is a woman, definitely not Bert Montoya. Cops keep digging.
If you look at this property, there really wasn't a whole lot of yard there. But it was enough that if you had to do it by shovel, it would take you probably a considerable amount of days. So we requested a backhoe to come in and to assist us in digging the entire yard.
Puente wants a word with Detective Cabrera.
She said, am I under arrest? Well, at that particular time, she wasn't. And so, you know, I said, well, no, you're not under arrest. And why? And she said, you know, all this is making me nervous, and I would like to go have a cup of coffee with one of my relatives just around the corner at the hotel.
Cabrera walks Puente to the hotel, then gets back to work.
And it was about 21 minutes later that I was digging in this area that I struck something. And I dug down deeper and I pulled. And when I did, all of a sudden, here came a lake. And at that point, I knew there was definitely something had gone on here. And I remember that sinking feeling, you know, that the reason she had summoned me is because I was probably maybe 2 feet away from discovering that body, and she wasn't about to be there when I pulled it up. I immediately yelled for my commander. I remember him asking me, "Where's Dorothea?" I said, "She's over at the hotel having coffee." He ran off to get her. A few minutes later, he comes back. He says, "She's gone."
Cops start searching for the slippery Puente. A third body is dug up. Deputy Coroner Laura Santos.
This body was wrapped in numerous layers of wrapping, quilts, bedspreads, plastic, and some of it was stitched together. And so we couldn't see anything at that point, and we didn't want to disturb any of the evidence. Two forensic pathologists from my office came over to the site to see what the body looked like in position. And then the whole board with the body and all the evidence, all the wrappings, was transported to the coroner's office.
Detectives canvass the neighborhood. The next-door neighbor reports asking Puente about the bad odors coming from 1426. Detective Cabrera.
When she was contacted, she just simply told him that she just put some fertilizer out in her yard, and that probably is the origin of the smell.
And, as the LA Times' Peter King notes, that same neighbor makes a more recent and more grisly discovery.
He went out in the morning in the backyard and he found 24 human teeth, all of them filled with silver and gold fillings.
On Sunday, November 13th, two more cloth and plastic wrapped bodies are pulled out of the ground. As photographer David Morris explains, the air on F Street is not good.
It was like something was spoiled. I have photographs of people holding their hands up to their mouths, you know, just covering their nose so they don't smell it. Some were wearing like those little face masks. It's definitely the smell was in the air.
Deputy Coroner Santos realizes the bodies are revealing secrets.
It was obvious almost right from the beginning that some of them had been buried much longer than others. Some appeared to have only been buried maybe a few weeks to a couple of months. Some appeared to have been buried for a year or two. The rates of decomposition were greatly different.
But how can this little old lady dig graves in her yard? John Cabrera.
We would discover the parolees from the halfway house came and dug the holes, but they didn't have any idea what was really going to be put in the holes. She paid them cash, they went about their way.
One of those parolees digging holes is named Don Anthony. Remember him telling Judy Moise he was that long-lost uncle of Bert's? It's a strong connection to Puente. On Monday, November 14th, another two corpses are pulled from the earth. One corpse shares a macabre secret.
What was different about this particular body is that the remains had no head, no hands, and no feet. The reason for cutting off her head, hands, and feet were if by some chance someone did find the body, they wouldn't know who it was.
Imagine the effort it takes to saw off two hands, 2 feet, and one head. Cabrera moves his search back inside 1426 F Street.
We were able to gather up somewhere probably over 300 items of evidence from the outside and the interior of the boarding house. I found a book right on the table, and the book was Drugs and Their Effects. So basically, I just looked at it as this was Dorothea's cookbook. And then along on the kitchen table, I found a driver's license. And the driver's license had Dorothea's picture on it, but not Dorothea's name.
And they locate the source of that smell.
Apparently, this is the room she kept her victims in. And they might have been there up to a week, maybe 2 weeks. And the body fluids would penetrate the carpet and then down into the floor. And this is what created a very foul smell. And when we rolled the carpet back, it was very, very bad.
Outside, the media continues to gather, including L.A. Times reporter Peter King.
At one point, the full city block in front of her house there on F Street was shoulder to shoulder with people from sidewalk to sidewalk. Kids in their parochial school uniforms, Sacramento lobbyists on their luncheon breaks, and everybody standing out there.
Deputy Coroner Laura Santos struggles to put names to cadavers.
The usual means of identification of victims in a case like this is number one, fingerprints, number two, dental records. But in this case, most of the bodies were too decomposed to do fingerprints. All but one of the victims did not have any teeth. We actually received an offer of help from the Social Security Department, and one of their agents from San Francisco offered to give us a list of everyone who had received Social Security benefits at that address for the past 3 or 4 years.
Those names include Vera Martin, Dorothy Miller, James Gallup, Leona Carpenter, and Betty Palmer. Their checks keep coming to Puente because nobody reported them missing.
Puente chose her victims carefully. She chose people to live there who didn't have a lot of contact with their families or didn't have any family at all, and they were isolated. And so most of them had no one that was looking for them.
The massive media storm generates a call from the family of a 77-year-old man named Everson Gilmuth.
I didn't quite know what they were referring to or what they were talking about.
He learns Gilmuth had initiated a pen pal romance with a soon-to-be-released prison inmate. The inmate's name, Dorothea Puente. And in 1985, Gilmuth lights out to California to marry her.
During this period from 1986 to 1988, she was still in contact with his family through letters, always telling them about how she and Everson was doing things and traveling and all of this. In fact, it wasn't until this case had hit the news media that the family made contact with me wanting to know how their father was.
The family hasn't seen him for 3 years. Cabrera starts studying similarities in all seven corpses.
All the bodies that we were bringing up were wrapped with a lot of duct tape, plastic, sheets. I put out a bulletin to all agencies asking if they'd had any bodies that were found in this similar manner. And shortly after I had put it out, Sutter County homicide detectives got a hold of me and said, yeah, you know, in 1986 we had a body found.
And Sutter County puts Cabrera in touch with a guy named Bill Clausen. Clausen had reached out to police about the unexpected death of his mother, Ruth Monroe. Ruth had died shortly after moving into Puente's boarding house.
My brother and I moved her in on Easter Sunday, and I stopped by every day after work. I'd go by and see her. About 2 weeks went by, and then I noticed my mom had a drink in her hand, and she didn't drink. So I asked her what it was, and she said that Dorothea had fixed her a drink.
Clausen reports his mother soon getting sick. She couldn't speak. She couldn't even move.
So I kind of sat on the edge of the bed, put my hand on her, and kind of pulled her down a little bit and told her that she'd be okay, that Dorothea was taking care of her, you know, everything was okay. And then I left. The next morning, I got a phone call that she was dead.
And so the coroner showed up and investigated. What Dorothea had told the authorities is that Ruth Monroe was a very depressed person. And so there wasn't any reason to suspect that any foul play had taken place. Later on, we would find from her family that that wasn't so. She was upbeat, she was happy. And then the next minute, she's dead. And then here's Dorothea telling authorities, she was a very depressed person. And so given that circumstances, we added Ruth's death now as a homicide.
Fuentes on the run as the magnitude of her crimes become clear. In addition to the 7 bodies found in her yard, she's now a suspect in the disappearance of Everson Gilmeth and the poisoning of Ruth Monroe. Police chase leads as far away as Las Vegas and Mexico. Then, the phone rings at LAPD dispatch. The call is from a television news show. A retired handyman has reported he spent the afternoon drinking with a talkative little old lady.
During this time that they were together, the subject of conversation was him receiving Social Security benefits. And so he called the authorities, and they went out to where he knew she was staying.
At 10:20 p.m. on Wednesday, November 16th, L.A. cops knock at a motel room door.
And at first, she gave them a different name when they asked who she was. But they didn't buy into that, and they wanted to know, see some ID or something along that line. And it was at that time she just said, okay, my name is Dorothea Puente.
Photographer Tom Parker gets a hot tip. He lights out to capture the perp walk.
Somebody had called me and told me that they were bringing her in. So I went out to Executive Airport, and that's where they brought her in. They got her off the plane. She's handcuffed and just a little old grandma-looking type.
Detective John Cabrera puts the heat to Puente.
She wasn't very talkative, but she was very open about, her cashing the victim's checks. And I remember her apologizing. But she was very adamant about not killing anybody.
Still, 7 corpses have been exhumed from her yard, and Puente is charged with murder. The coroners work around the clock to identify the bodies they've dug up. 2 of the dead produce fingerprints and are identified through a military database. They are Dorothy Miller and Bert Montoya. It's a sad day for social worker Judy Moise, who kickstarted the investigation.
If Puente had a motive for killing Alberto, it was that he knew too much and that he knew too many people that he could report that this was done.
One of the bodies has 4 tattoos, identifying him as 55-year-old Ben Fink. And one by one, the dead find names. James Gallup, Leona Carpenter, Vera Faye Martin, and Betty Palmer. On June 19, 1990, 9 charges of murder are filed against Puente. Hey, Murder Time fans. This holiday season, I want to give a gift to my loved ones that makes them feel special and unique, just like the relationship we share. That's why I'm giving everyone I care about Storyworth. Storyworth is an online service that helps you and your loved ones preserve precious memories and stories for years to come. It's a thoughtful and meaningful gift that connects you to those who matter most. Every week, Storyworth emails your relative or friend a thought-provoking question of your choice from their vast pool of possible options. Each unique prompt asks questions you've never thought to ask, like, what's the bravest thing you've ever done in your life? Or, if you could see into the future, what would you want to find out? After 1 year, Storyworth will compile all your loved ones' stories, including photos, into a beautiful keepsake book that you'll be able to share and revisit for generations to come. I've just started using it with my whole family, excluding my parents, as I'm going to give it to them next year for Christmas, which will be a trip down memory lane and a wonderful keepsake. Reading the weekly stories helps connect you with loved ones no matter how near or far apart you are. It can end up being pretty funny sometimes also. The things my family's been willing to reveal in these stories are incredible. It has me seeing some of them in a whole new light. With Storyworth, I'm giving those I love most a thoughtful, personal gift from the heart and preserving their memories and stories for years to come. Go to storyworth.com/crime and save $10 on your first purchase.
That's storyworth.com/crime to save $10 on your first purchase. Healthy snacks have a bad reputation. And let's be honest, most don't taste very good. They don't fill you up, and they certainly don't satisfy your cravings. This episode is sponsored by Monk Pack, who makes snacks that taste like our favorite sugary treats, but with 1 gram of sugar or less. Monk Pack Keto Granola Bars contain just 1 gram of sugar, 2 to 3 grams of net carbs, and they're only 140 calories. They're gluten-free, grain-free, plant-based, and non-GMO. With no soy, trans fat, sugar alcohols, or high-intensity sweeteners. While they're great for anyone following a keto lifestyle, you absolutely do not have to be keto to love these. They're the perfect snack for anyone who's trying to eat better or cut back on sugar and carbs without sacrificing taste. I've been trying to eat healthier, and I found snacking to be so boring because it was tough to mix it up, and I love sweet foods. Baby carrots, almonds, dried fruit just wasn't cutting it. Monk Pack is now my go-to snack, as it's nutritious and delicious. It doesn't feel like I'm making a conscious, healthy decision because I really like eating them, so it actually feels like I'm making a tasty decision. Monk Pack Keto Granola Bars have a soft and chewy texture and come in delicious flavors like coconut cocoa chip, peanut butter, and blueberry almond vanilla. I love the blueberry almond vanilla flavor. It's soft, but also chewy. And to be honest, it reminded me of a cereal bar from when I was a kid, but it tastes even better. I bet if I was given the option then, I would have picked Monk Pack over that other brand. They're perfect for a quick breakfast, a snack between Zoom calls, or a guilt-free dessert. They taste incredible, and you can't beat the low-sugar nutrition they provide. And by shopping online, you can avoid another trip to the grocery store by getting Monk Pack delivered right to your door. Try it for yourself and you'll see. And we have a special deal for our listeners. Get 20% off your first purchase of any Monk Pack product by visiting monkpack.com and entering our code CRIME at checkout. And Monk Pack is so confident in their product, it's backed with a 100% satisfaction guarantee. If you don't like it for any reason, they'll exchange the product or refund your money, whichever you prefer. To get started, just go to munkpack.com and select any product. Then, enter the code CRIME at checkout to save 20% off your purchase. Monk Pack, delicious, nutritious food you can count on. We thank them for sponsoring the podcast.
There was a reason they were in these graves, and someone else had to be involved.
On February 3rd, 1993, mass murderer Puente faces the music. Prosecutor John O'Mara faces a daunting task. Cause of death can't be positively proven. The victims are just too far gone. But as Deputy Coroner Laura Santos explains, a simple fact just can't be ignored.
And obviously, since these people were buried, many of them were bound, wrapped. You know, it was pretty obvious they didn't dig holes and jump in themselves. Just because the coroner cannot determine the cause of death doesn't mean we can't classify a death as a homicide.
It's a massive case. 156 witnesses take the stand. And more than 3,000 exhibits are presented. Even with the deadly drug Dalmain present in all the buried bodies, no one actually witnessed Puente administer the lethal doses. The defense does not contest that Puente stole and even buried victims in her yard to perpetrate her thieving. Writer Carla Norton explains.
That became really critical during the trial because the defense was trying to portray that these people died of natural causes. And indeed, they had every illness you could name. So, if you can't prove cause of death, can you prove murder? Their point of view was that they just simply died, and then she buried them and continued to collect their checks.
There is no testimony from the accused. Defense attorney Peter Vallotton.
Dorothea Puente did not take the stand. John O'Mara was a very good, very tenacious prosecutor, and Puente would be no match for him on the stand.
On July 15th, 1993, the 12-person jury begins deliberations.
and following the longest period of deliberation in California history, the jury returns its verdict. Lead Detective John Cabrera.
Out of 9 counts of murder, she was convicted on 3 of them. 4 of those counts, which were 4 bodies and victims out of her yard, would go 11 to 1. That is 11 guilty, 1 not guilty. 2 of the cases would evenly split.
On October 13th, 1993, Puente is found guilty of the first-degree murder of Ben Fink and Dorothy Miller, and the second-degree murder of Leona Carpenter. On the remaining 6 counts, including those of Ruth Monroe, Everson Gilmeth, and Bert Montoya, the judge declares a mistrial. But Puente's definitely going upriver.
She was sentenced to 2 life terms without parole and then an additional 25 to life on those 3 counts.
Following the Puente trial, Social Security regulations are tightened, and they build a national database to track all applicants. But for Judy Moise, whose tenacity and instinct kicked off the investigation, life was never the same.
Personally, I wasn't able to work anymore as a street counselor. I did stay for another 6 months, but I no longer had that type of enthusiasm for it.
Puente may have changed our image of a serial killer, says photographer Alex Clausen.
When you think of a mass murderer, you don't think of a grandmotherly type of lady. She appeared more like somebody that would be baking cookies for the neighborhood children. If the police hadn't discovered bodies, she would have continued to kill.
Yet for some, doubt lingers. John Cabrera.
And there are people still today that I run into that still shake their head in disbelief and want to just tell me, you know, I don't know. Did she really do that? And of course, my answer was yes. She did every one of them.
She did every one of them. Puente died in the Central California Women's Facility in Chowchilla, California, on March 17th, 2011. And that's your murder time for today. Thanks for listening.
Simon Decker wrote and produced The Slaying Senior, working with files from the television series Crime Stories, Blood Lies and Alibis, and Catching Killers. Our executive producer is Ron Getz. Our supervising producer is Robert Laughlin. And our technical producer is Joe Watts. Murder Time is a production of Partners in Motion.